Well, good morning, Chapel. Happy Mother's Day. Or, I'm sorry, probably Mothering Sunday. Yeah, there we go. Happy Mothering Sunday, especially greetings to all the mothers. And, you know, there's more than one way to be a mother. There really is. When I first came to living faith in Christ as a teenager, there's an older woman in the church who's really old. I think she was almost 40, I think, actually. Which, as a 14-year-old boy, seemed pretty old at the time. And she played a very important part in my spiritual growth. Whenever she saw me, she would take time out to listen to my life. She made herself available for me to talk to, and she'd always pray with me. And at first, I found it really strange. She'd ask me how school was. And, you know, I don't know how, looking back, she made me feel like the most interesting person in the world. And I thought, wow, you know. But it was incredible patience on her part, because I would just go on about this, my dumb math teacher, or this or that, and she'd just listen and nod, and afterwards she'd say, well, let me pray for you about that. And she wasn't a married woman, and didn't have any kids of her own there at the church, but she was very much a spiritual mother to me. And so whether you're a Christian and you give yourself to caring for people in the church and you're a spiritual mom or a real mom or both, we just want to express great appreciation for all of those who take time to use those feminine maternal instincts just to care for and nurture other people. It's a great gift, especially within the churches. Young Christians and people find Christ. You need spiritual parents. You need spiritual moms and dads. Especially if you don't come from a home where you have moms and dads who've taught you about Jesus. So thank you for those of you who are out there. Now, we've been going through the book of Genesis for quite some time, and lately we've been focusing on this fella named Joseph. Appreciate that many of you have heard different events so far in his life. He starts off, we meet him when he's 17 years old. He has big dreams. He's a gifted, skilled young man. Unfortunately, his brothers are very jealous of him, very envious of him. They don't like all the favor he's got. And so he's kidnapped. He's trafficked as a slave down into Egypt as a laborer. And yet he has a different attitude towards probably anybody else who was trafficked down there or sold as a slave. He gave himself to work well. He rose up early, went to bed late. He took great responsibility for all his work and care, always tried to do the best job. And the master noticed this, and he soon put Joseph in charge of the whole place. He became like his personal PA, rose to a rather high status, as high as you could, at least, as a slave. And was entrusted with a lot, and then we see that from his wife, he was falsely accused of sexual assault, and he ends up back in prison. But in prison, what does he do? Does he fall into a pit of self-pity? Does he complain? Does he moan? No, he goes right back to being the best prisoner he knows how to be, to tidying things up, to helping the officers tidy and clean and make sure everything's run officially, and soon the jailer basically gives him his own set of keys. Basically puts him in charge of running much of the prison. And so life is not working out well for Joseph, and yet we see in every situation he goes in and he tries to make the best of that situation. And that's where we pick up. We're in chapter 40. It says, after this, the king's cupbearer and baker offended their master, the king of Egypt. All right, so at this time, Joseph is in the prison, but something's happening outside those prison walls in the nation. And the two very important people. Now, we don't have cupbearers, and baker may not sound like a high position, but this is the king's personal baker. And so not only for him, this is for all the guests. This is like, I don't know who does the baking for whenever there's a state visit down at Downing Street or down there for, you know, Buckingham Palace or whenever big foreign dignitaries come in. And, you know, I don't know who makes the bread for that, but it's probably not just your average baker. It's probably the best baker. It's the baker to the queen, you know. And cupbearer, that may not, we don't really maybe use that term too much. Like, what does a cupbearer do? Does he just stand there and hold the cup? Like, what's his job, actually? Cupbearer, there's no real equivalent. The closest thing I could come up with, like, is a personal butler. Or I was talking to my wife, and she was explaining to me that I was about to call it Pride and Prejudice. No, Downton Abbey, that's what it is. It all kind of blurs together for me. Downton Abbey, the Carson, you know, he's the guy who takes care of his lordship, and he oversees everything. He's in charge of the food, he's in charge of this. That's what the cupbearer was. He was like the royal butler. He was in charge of the food, and there's also a sense of security, because back then the way to get rid of a king was to poison him. And so the cupbearer was in charge of making sure none of the food was poisoned, none of the wine was poisoned, and he would be the one to personally draw the wine and bring the wine to the king to ensure that the wine was safe to drink. So it's a combination of like bodyguard, butler, all sorts of things rolled into one. So these are a couple of very important jobs. And it says, but tragically, both of these people had offended their master, the king of Egypt. It offended him. The word there in Hebrew is they actually did something offensible. It wasn't like they had a bad day, like the guy was carrying the wine and he accidentally tripped and spilled it or something like this. It wasn't anything silly. It was actually they committed an offense. It would have been a crime of some sort. Somehow these two, the Bible leaves it open, doesn't really explain what they did. But they brought offense, they committed an offense to the throne. And this is at a country in a time where kings and queens had real power. A lot of times, certainly here in Europe, largely kings and queens have, they're kind of symbolic heads of state. And you kind of have to go to places like Saudi Arabia to find a king with any like real authority and real power that, you know, to insult them is a crime. And is that sort of environment. They committed an offense against the throne, a legitimate offense, and they are put into prison. Why weren't they executed? Well, what would normally happen with executions is when certain things are done, when political crimes are done, when treason is done, people are put in a special political prison, and then you wait for a special holiday, for a special celebration, a big political day of sorts, and then you bring all these people out from death row, and that's when they're executed. So they are put, they offend their master, and says, verse 2, Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard in the prison where Joseph was confined. So they go to a very special sort of political prison. For their offense. The Pharaoh is very angry with what they did. Once again, we don't know exactly what it is that they did, but it was something bad enough for both of them to come under the wrath and anger of the king and for it to be considered a real legitimate offense. And they're put in this special prison reserved for high-ranking sort of political prisoners. And who does the jailer put in charge of looking after these two very important guys? These are like cabinet-level fellas, you know, people of national importance. Well, who does he put? Who's his best guy? Well, it's Joseph. Joseph, the one who's always diligent, the one who's always going the extra mile. We talked last week, you know, for those of you who are managers or own your own business, that you just dream of hiring a Joseph. Like, that would be great to have a guy come along with that sort of attitude. And so these two guys are sent his way, and the jailer thinks, ooh, these are top-level guys. I better make sure they are looked after very carefully as long as they're under my care. So Joseph does that. Verse 4, the captain of the guard assigned Joseph to them, and he became their personal attendant, and they were in custody for some time. So these fellas are sitting on death row waiting, when is the king going to decide to execute me? They're sitting there regretting what they had done. Once again, don't know what it was, but they were sitting there knowing that they had committed legitimate offense against the king. The Egyptian king's cupbearer and baker, who were confined in the prison, each had a dream. Both had a dream on the same night, and each dream had its own meaning. Dreams were very important back then, and they can even be important to some today. In our sort of post-Freudian world, we kind of get these dreams every now and then, and we wake up and we think, goodness gracious, what is wrong with me that I'm dreaming this crazy stuff? How many of you ever had that? You have a dream the whole night, you wake up and you're like, oh, wow, I've got issues. Like, you know, I don't know, should I pray or should I go see the therapist? Like, what is the matter with me? And so we get dreams, and dreams were very important to people back then. There was a whole special career of really dream interpreters, something across between a magician and a therapist, really, back in Egypt. You know, there are books written on what dreams meant. And so God is at work here. In this prison, these two guys are sitting in prison, awaiting their fate for their crimes, and God looks at these two guys, and he sends dreams their way. Joseph comes to them in the morning, sees they look distraught, and so he asks Pharaoh's officers who were in custody with him in his master's house, why do you guys look so sad today? Well, again, Joseph is not your typical prisoner. He's a prisoner who's put in charge of looking after other prisoners. And he comes in and just doesn't give them their breakfast or their food. He comes in and says, hey, guys, you look a little troubled. What's the matter? He actually cares about his job. He actually cares about other people. You know, you'd think, how many of you, like when life goes wrong for you, you just begin cut off caring for other people? Like, that's the temptation for all of us, isn't it? It's like, I have enough of my problems without having to think about your mess. You look a bit sad and depressed, but hey, tough luck. I've been human trafficked, okay? I should not be here in this jail in Egypt right now. I was the favorite son of my father. I should be back in Canaan, eating at his table, running the family business. And we can, you know, when life is hard for us, we get a little bit. We get a little jaded, a little cynical. Our hearts get hard, and we just don't give a rip about other people's hard day. Joseph's of a different spirit. You know, we've seen over the last few weeks, God's been working in this guy's life. He's not the selfish little brat that he was when he was 17 years old. And so he comes in, these two guys looking a bit troubled and upset, and he asks them, you know, he says, you know, why are you guys looking so sad? We had dreams, they said to him, but there is no one to interpret them. So they tell him, hey, we each had a dream last night. It was very clear, maybe a bit disturbing, a bit troubling, but, you know, we don't have our therapist here. We don't have our magician here. We don't have our special guy to come and, you know, sit us on the sofa and ask us about our childhood and if our dad hugged us a lot. And, you know, what do these things possibly mean to us? If you were in that situation, what would you say? Oh, well, oof, tough luck. Hope you get that figured out, buddy. For many of us, that would have been our response. But here's what Joseph says. Don't interpretations belong to God? Tell me your dreams. As Christians, we can be arrogant sometimes. We come to somebody who's not a believer, someone who doesn't believe and know Jesus. And when we finally get up the courage to maybe talk to them, to maybe share our faith with them, we sometimes can be under the mistaken impression that this is the first time they've ever thought about God. Or this is the first time God is encountering their life when we as a Christian come and we bring the message of Jesus to them, and, you know, their whole life has been in utter darkness, but we're going to tell them about Christ. Now, sometimes there is a little bit of truth to that. But I've found out, and what we see for here is God is at work in people's lives long before we arrive and show up there. It is right for those of us who have experienced forgiveness from Jesus. We've experienced his love. We've experienced his goodness. It's right that we should want to share that with other people. Like, we'd be pretty selfish if we didn't. You know, you get forgiven of sins. You get filled with love and hope. And you're like, great, I'm going to keep this a secret. Make sure no one I care about knows about this stuff. That would be selfish of us. And yet, we shouldn't think that the first time we go to talk to them, that God has never been at work in that person's life. And so God is at work in these guys' lives, giving them dreams, and then Joseph is the next step in that process for these guys. In a similar situation, I think I've told this story at least once before here, so forgive me if you heard this before. I remember once, my wife and I were living in Marseille, there in the south of France. And as you may know, it's a port city, and the whole city is packed full of North Africans. I mean, Algerians, Moroccans, Tunisians. Far more Islam is practiced there than Catholicism or anything else, you know. So it's a very heavily Muslim city, and there are many people there who had never seen a Bible before. They'd never met a Christian before. And you can just go out in the port and there in the streets, very open. They're happy to talk to you about God. That's kind of what they do in their culture. They don't, like, you talk to a French person about God, they run away. They're panicked. Like, they run away and scream. If you bring up, hey, God, they run, hold on to their wallet, and, you know, they're scared to death. The North Africans, they're very different attitude. And I remember talking with a young lady once there in Marseille. And she goes, oh, you're a Christian. And I said, yeah, well, I helped to lead this church. And she said, well, I've been just, you know, if you're willing to talk to me about God, I've been having these dreams lately. I'm like, really? What sort of dreams? Well, in this dream, I'm standing on one side of a river, and there's a guy on the other side of the river, and he's walking towards me, and he walks right through this river, and he comes to me, and he's dressed all in white and has a rainbow over his head. There's a sword coming out of his mouth, and he takes this book and he hands it to me, and I don't know what the book is. I know it's not the Quran, but he hands me this book and tells me I'm supposed to read it, and if I read it, I'll find eternal life. And I've just been keep having this dream, and no one at the mosque can explain it to me. Do you know what this dream means? And like, you don't have to have a special, if you're a Christian, you don't have to have a special gift of dream interpretation on this one. I'm like, you know what? I just might have an idea who the guy in your dream is. You've heard of the prophet Jesus? Oh, yes. Let me tell you a little more about him. What was it? God was already working in her life before I showed up. And for many people that we encounter and we think, you know what, I'd love to share something, my faith with this person. It often begins by listening. A lot of the most effective ways of sharing our faith, what God has done in our life, is to start off not by talking, but by asking questions. And that's what Joseph does. He said, don't interpretations belong to God? Can you please tell me your dream? And so the other guy talks while Joseph just listens. Joseph wants to find out, well, what is it that God has already shown this person? Very often when I'm talking to someone, you know, in the times when maybe I've just been out in public and I've been with a group of Christians and we thought, right, let's just approach people and begin to share our faith. Very often I just like to begin by asking questions. What comes through your mind when you hear the word God? Have you ever had any kind of weird experience? I don't know, dreams, anything supernatural, answers to prayer? What do you think of prayer? And just let the person talk. And sometimes a person will talk for like 20, 30 minutes if you'll just shut up. I mean, really, they'll be like, oh, you know what? My granny used to pray, and I know she really believed. And when she would pray, sometimes things would happen. But, you know, she died some time ago. And, you know, I've always thought about going to church, but never actually done it. And it's just interesting. People have a story. And sometimes the stories are a bit weird, you know. I'm sure one night aliens came and visited me. You know, sometimes you get some weird stuff when you just shut up and listen. Really, you can get some freaky stuff. But you listen, and you begin to ask the person, what goes through your mind about God? And this is what Joseph's doing. Interpretations belong to God. Tell me your dream. Wow, that's a step of faith too, isn't it? I mean, really, just to say that. I mean, how many of us would do that at workplace or at school? How many of us, you know, would do that in those environments? We kind of come in the office, we get our coffee, and a couple of our coworkers are talking about some dream they had the other night. And, you know, maybe making jokes about, you know, you got some issues, or, you know, what's going on with you? How many of us would just laugh along, and how many of us would say, hey, wait a minute, you know, God's in the dream business. Tell me what it is, what you're talking about. I mean, you're kind of putting yourself out there, right? You're kind of depending on the fact that God might actually give you wisdom in that moment to know what their dream means. And frankly, a lot of us would be petrified in that moment. And Joseph's going out there. He's just, hey, dreams belong to God. Tell me your dream. Yeah. You never get to walk on water if you don't step out of the boat. Yeah. If any time people begin to see miracles or God at work in this way, it requires a bit of risk. We don't see miracles. We don't see God move in supernatural ways without stepping out and putting ourselves in a position of possible failure, of possible risk. And that's what Joseph does. It says, so the chief cupbearer told his dream to Joseph. In my dream, there was a vine in front of me. On the vine were three branches. As soon as it budded, its blossoms came out and its clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. So he explains this dream to the cupbearer. Very appropriate dream for a cupbearer. You know, symbolically, there's three clusters of grapes floating around there, and he grabs them, and it just goes into his cup, and he carries, he carries this wine to Pharaoh, and it's all a bit surreal, and he's trying to explain this to Joseph. And Joseph, with confidence, says, this is its interpretation. The three branches are 3 days. In just 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your position. You will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand the way you used to when you were his cupbearer. Joseph listens to the dream and he says, and he brings this word of restoration. He says, I'll tell you what your dream means. He says, those three clusters, those are 3 days. And then the king of Egypt, that is the Pharaoh, the king is going to restore you. And you're not going to be in jail anymore. He's not going to be angry with you anymore. You're not going to be under this judgment anymore. You're not going to be awaiting death anymore. But instead, you're going to be restored. And once again, you're going to have that relationship with the king that you've lost. You're going to have the relationship with the king that you desire, that you regret this offense that you committed, but that's going to be pardoned and you're going to be restored. It's a great word Joseph brings this man in prison, a word of restoration. And then all of a sudden, this is interesting. We kind of shift gears here. The last couple chapters, Joseph has been very impressive. He's been exemplary. And yet he says something now that's really like, yo, you almost get whiplash here because, you know, he's been, every time he talks, he's saying something godly and good. And yet in this moment, all of a sudden, he gives this interpretation. And then he says, but when all goes well for you, remember that I was with you. Please show kindness to me by mentioning me to Pharaoh and get me out of this prison. For I was kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I have done nothing that they should put me in this dungeon. So up until now, you know, he's been speaking God's word, and he's been righteous, and you know, we feel for him because he's in, you know, some terrible circumstances, even though he's shining and make the best of it. God's at work in him. God is preparing Joseph for a destiny. God has a plan for Joseph. Joseph is a gifted, skilled guy. And yet his character, as we saw at age 17, when he was 17, he's very immature. And yet we've seen he's been growing and he's been making the best of bad circumstances and he's been growing up and maturing. And yet in this moment, the moment God uses him in a supernatural way to give this dream, prophetic dream interpretation, the moment after God uses him in a miraculous way, he goes right back to thinking about himself. He's like, hey, get me out of this situation. It's not fair. Something happened to me, and guess what? I don't deserve it. In fact, I did nothing at all to contribute to these bad circumstances I'm in. So please, you know, God's used me to do a miracle in your life, so please pay me back. You know, pay me back for God's miracle. When you get out of here, you know, pull some strings for me, all right? And we see him, once again, not in the best light. He's kind of trying to manipulate his future. He's maybe sounds a little self-righteous. Hey, I didn't do anything. Bit defensive. And it seems weird, but goodness, isn't this just like you and me? How often, you know, God uses us in some way. Maybe here at chapel where, you know, we get here early to prepare the coffee or set up chairs and, you know, do a sound test or the musicians here. You know, we do serve God in some way. And then we go home and have a bad attitude with our family. We get to share the gospel with someone at work. And then we do some really dumb sin that we know better that we should not be doing. You know. Isn't this just like you and me? God blesses us, God uses us, we grow up, we mature, we have a victory, and then we absolutely screw up all over again. You see, this is how we get mature. This side of heaven, there's no end to the Christian life. If you've been a Christian more than 5 minutes, you figured out, you know what? This is not a sprint. This is a marathon. And throughout our lives, no matter how many years, no matter how many decades you've been a Christian, you're going to experience times where you feel you're growing and that you're walking with Jesus and things are great. And then the next minute, God shows you this big area of immaturity in your life. No, you still have a lot of growing up to do. This side of eternity, there's still room to grow. This side of eternity, we never stay the same. We don't, you know, put the car in neutral. We're always wanting to go forward and grow with God. And if we're wanting to grow in God, if we're wanting to grow in love and faith, if we're wanting to grow to become more like Jesus, God will answer that prayer. And often he answers us by, in some embarrassing ways, by showing us just how messed up we are in certain parts of our life. God, Jesus, just change me to be more like you. God, help me to have a good character and be a loving, righteous, holy person. Next thing God does is he puts this mirror in front of our face and shows us, ah, right, I've got work to do here in these areas. And so Joseph, though God's using him in some great ways here in prison, we also see he's got some areas of growth. Well, the chief baker sees this. He hears the word that, the cupbearer got. The chief baker saw the interpretation was positive, and he said to Joseph, oh, hey, I also had a dream. The three baskets of white bread were on my head. In the top basket were all sorts of baked goods for Pharaoh, but the birds were eating them out of the basket on my head. This is the interpretation, Joseph replied. The three baskets are 3 days. In just 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from off you and hang you on a tree. Then the birds will eat the flesh from your body. Word of judgment. To be honest, it's probably what he was expecting, that sort of thing, while he was in jail. He had been waiting to be executed, and that would have been a typical Egyptian way to execute somebody at the time, to hang them on a tree and just leave them there. So the wine bearer, he gets a word of restoration, that his life's going to be given back to him. The baker, all the white bread, the dream with the baskets, he is going to get the reward of his crimes. So what's the point of this whole sermon this morning? Cut down on the carbs, drink more red wine, you'll live longer. The end. Anyone ready to be saved from that message? Like, can I give an altar call right here? You can just put your Asda white loaf right here. We'll open a bottle of Merlot and, you know, we'll have us some church. There's a little more to it than that. I joke, but we could do with less carbs. But that's not the point of the message. Joseph gives a word of restoration to one of these guys. The other guy, he goes off and he pays the crime. He pays the punishment for his crime. And it says there in verse 20, Joseph's word came to pass. On the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, he gave a feast for all his servants. He lifted up the heads of the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. Pharaoh restored the chief cupbearer to his position as cupbearer, and he placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. But Pharaoh hanged the chief baker, just as Joseph had explained to them. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph. He forgot him. God's looking down on this life, on this man that has his gifting level is way up here, and though his character has improved, his character does not quite match his level of gifting. And God has a destiny for this guy, but but he's not quite there yet. God looks down and says, he's not ready for the purposes I have for him. And so God says, you need to wait in this prison a little longer. You need to wait in this jail just a little bit longer, because you're not ready for what it is I want to do with you. And sometimes God has us in seasons like that. God says, wait a minute, I've given you skills, I've given you gifts, and yet at this point, no, you're not ready. And God has us in a difficult circumstance so we can grow. But one of these days we're going to get out of that. I'm going to read something here from, there's a book I have here called Pensée, or Thoughts. You may have never heard of it. It's kind of an older book, about 300-400 years old. But you may have heard of the author. The author's name is a guy named Blaise Pascal. And if you're a computer geek at all, you're familiar with Pascal language. This was a language of computers. And it was named after this guy Pascal, because Pascal's the first guy in history to create a calculating machine, the world's first calculator. And he did it without computer chips or electricity. Well done. Like, you can pull that off. He was the leading mathematical genius in France during the Enlightenment at his time. He was a young man, and yet he was gifted, just like Joseph, just gifted off the charts gifting when it came to mathematics. And he would have been a contemporary of Voltaire and other French intellects at the time. And yet he got to a certain point in his life where he was just struggling with life. He was gifted. He had intelligence. He had all these things. And yet, life just didn't make sense for him. He was looking around at the world and was thinking, there has to be more. And he ended up coming to Christ. Like, he had a powerful conversion experience where he met God and just began to follow Christ. And then, tragically, his life, he died. He died not long after that. And after they buried him, they went in his office, and there was all these papers everywhere, journaling his thoughts about life, about God, about purpose, about meaning. And, you know, from before and after his conversion, about after him meeting Christ. And he was one day, probably hoping to bring it all together to make a book, but he died. And so they just gathered everything together, and it was published on this book called Pensée, or Thoughts. And so I got the English translation a number of years back and read it through. And interestingly, in several places, he writes down what he sees as what the world is like, or what some people call the human condition. What does it mean to be human on this planet, in this world? And he writes these things twice. And I want you to see if this reminds us a little bit of what we just read with Joseph. He says, imagine a number of men in chains, all under the sentence of death, some of whom are each day butchered in the sight of others. Those remaining see their own condition in that of their fellows, and looking at each other with grief and despair, await their turn. This is the image of the human condition. We're all just stuck here on this planet, and people around us randomly die, and we just wait. Just wait our turn. In another place, sorry, my Kindle's being a bit slow here. a great bit about these gadgets. There we go. He says this in another place. He says, "When I see the blind and wretched state of man, when I survey the whole universe in its dumbness, and man left to himself with no light, as though lost in this corner of the universe without knowing who put him there, what he has come to do, what will become of him when he dies, incapable of knowing anything, I am moved to terror. Like a man transported in his sleep to some terrifying desert island, who wakes up quite lost and with no means of escape. Then I marvel that so wretched a state does not drive people to despair. I see other people around me, made like myself. I ask them if they are any better informed than I am, and they say they are not. Then these lost and wretched creatures look around and find some attractive object to which they become addicted and attached. For my part, I've never been able to form such attachments, and considering how very likely it is that there exists something besides what I can see, I have tried to find out whether God has left any traces of himself." That's what he writes in his journey to faith. This story shows us a similar picture. It shows us a similar picture that we are servants that have offended the king. We have brought offense against him, and rightly we are confined to this prison of a fallen humanity of sin and of death, where we just await the judgment of our sin. And yet, what does God do in this situation? He surprises us. He speaks a word of restoration. He comes to us and says, "No, you're not going to get what you deserve. Instead, I have come to restore you." Just like in the two dreams, Jesus Christ comes into this world, into our prison, shares our humanity, and he too talks about bread and wine, which we're about to partake of. But this bread and wine is together a word of restoration. It is a word that through the sacrifice of Christ, through his body, through his blood, which the bread and the wine here represent, through these things we find restoration with our King. We find forgiveness. We are pardoned for our crimes. We come to him in our guilty state, and he offers us his forgiveness. In this story that we read today, one man was restored while the other man was hung on a tree and subject to judgment. And guys, that's our message. That's what we are remembering this morning as we get ready to partake of communion. Jesus Christ went out and hung on a tree, taking the judgment so that we could be restored. He did it unlike the story, of course. In the story, the baker had no say in the matter. But when Jesus Christ comes, he comes voluntarily. He willingly, in love, lays his life down for us, satisfying the demands of justice, satisfying the judgment of the king, that you and I can be restored. And if you don't know that king, if you don't know that word of restoration, this is a great morning to get to know it.